Well, thank you. It's really an honor to be the last speaker of the day and also to follow such an inspiring panel about advocacy. I thought each one of those presentations was really absolutely terrific. I also want to thank Perry Hoffman and Dixie Ann Penny for organizing this conference. NIMH supports this conference because we believe it's important to try to disseminate scientific information about borderline personality disorder, in part to help people advocate for better research, better services, and better treatment. The National Institute of Mental Health is the major federal agency in the United States that's charged with supporting research on mental illness. And the mission of the NIMH is to reduce the burden of mental illness through research on mind, brain, and behavior. The priorities at NIMH are set with respect to scientific opportunity and public health importance. And it's important to remember that the NIMH budget, which this year is $1.4 billion, is really not our money, but it's really the taxpayers' money of the United States. And the accountability of the agency comes through two forms. One is a National Mental Health Advisory Council, which is like a board of directors made up of citizens from around the country. But the second that's very important is from the Congress. That is, when they send over the money every year, along with it, they send a report called the Congressional Report Language. And that's a report to the director saying, well, last year you did a fairly good job in supporting research on depression, but you haven't done very much on the issue of adherence or on the issue of personality disorders, so that every year when the director goes before Congress, he's going to be asked, well, what have you done to respond to the report language of last year? So that if you want milk and the field is in Washington, you don't sit on the edge and wait for the cow to come, but you rather speak to your congressman and have your congressman bring the cow over. So here are the numbers from BPD that you're very familiar with from today: 2% of adults, 75% suicide attempt, death from suicide between 8 and 10% of people who suffer from this disorder, and accounting for 20% of all psychiatric hospitalizations in the United States. The core message is that this is a disorder that has not received research attention that is commensurate with its prevalence in clinical settings and its seriousness. And this is something that we recognize. And our challenge really is to do what we can to stimulate research in this area. And part of what I want to talk to you about is how we're trying to do that and the extent to which we are or are not succeeding. Well, what makes the treatment so difficult and the suffering so severe, really, and clinician insecurity so vast with respect to borderline personality disorder? And these are my thoughts about this. We fundamentally don't understand the basic cause of this illness. We have, as we heard earlier, co-occurring conditions that make the clinical picture and treatment so confusing. Medication response is very, very difficult to predict from one person to the next, and really ultimately devolves into trial and error. Assessing treatment response is also very difficult. How do we know if a certain medication is working with this particular disorder? Difficult to say. The safety net in the services system, I'm sure I don't have to say, tell you, is extremely frayed, and there are inadequate provision from handling crises appropriately, both with criminal justice and within the mental health system. Patients differ widely from one to the other. So it's important to understand that one size doesn't fit all when it comes to treatment. And of course, assessing suicidality and impulsivity is very difficult and anxiety-provoking for clinicians. There's no doubt about that. Now, I just want to touch briefly on what I see as some of the critical research issues in the past and move on to where we see things going. Obviously, BPD has its origin in the 1940s in terms of borderline conditions that were thought of as in a simple bullseye model. That is, where you had the most serious mental illnesses, psychosis in the center, and neuroses around the periphery, and borderline was thought as something in between. During this time, really, in many ways, from the 50s all the way through the 70s, there were three different types of clinicians who used the term borderline in different ways. First was the office clinicians, who were oftentimes psychoanalysts, who would note that they had patients who came in who at first looked like they were going to be able to be treated with classical psychoanalysis, but after a period of a couple weeks, it became clear that the clinical condition was far more complicated. The patients oftentimes would decompensate or become suicidal, and a research literature out of this tradition talking about things such as the as-if personality or pseudoneurotic schizophrenia, ways to predict which patients would decompensate when treated with this treatment that seemed to be effective for other conditions. Now, a completely separate group were the researchers, and this were researchers who were working in the area of schizophrenia, particularly looking at the genetics of schizophrenia. And they noted in studying large family pedigrees of people with schizophrenia that there were family members in those pedigrees who did not themselves have schizophrenia, but who were somewhat odd and eccentric and had something which they called borderline schizophrenia. And indeed, there was research that indicated that this condition, borderline schizophrenia, was something that was found and genetically possibly related to schizophrenia. Then there were doctors working in hospital settings, such as Menninger's or Austin Riggs, Chestnut Lodge, McLean, and others, who noted that there were special patients who would come into the hospital. And these were oftentimes patients who were transferred from another institution after they had done very poorly. And they observed in the small social system of the hospital that these patients would have a particular effect on the environment. The patient would come in and oftentimes tell a very compelling story about how they had been mistreated in the past at the hands of other clinicians and mistreated at the place where they had come before. They would often find a staff member who would become their favorite staff member, and they would ask to spend more time with that person, and sometimes then would start keeping track of when that staff person was going to be on call so that they could be sure they're around, and maybe ask that staff person for their home phone number so that they could call on Saturday and Sunday when the staff person was off. And this relationship would grow, and the patient would become close to the special staff member. Meanwhile, the rest of the staff would see this relationship and become somewhat antagonistic towards it, and there would develop within the staff two views, really. One, that this was a patient who had a great deal of potential, who needed a great deal of loving care and attention. And then another contingent in the staff would feel, well, this is a manipulative person. This person does not need loving care and attention, but really needs some firm limits and really a good kick in the behind. Before too long, these two groups of staff members would be fighting with each other. You could call them the hardcore and the softcore. The hardcore would tell the softcore that, well, you're so sucked in by this patient that you probably need psychotherapy yourself. And the softcore would say, well, you know, you are so rigid and bureaucratic. I mean, after all, we didn't go into mental health in order to run a rigid bureaucracy. We're here to try to help people. So the staff would fight with each other. The patient would get worse and worse. And finally, the whole social situation becomes so chaotic in the hospital. The only thing everybody could agree upon is you have to transfer the patient to someplace else before the patient destroys us all. And there was a literature about this sort of pattern. And this is, I'm sure, something that you see happen today. And of course, this was described by Stanton and Schwartz about Chestnut Lodge and by Dr. Thomas Main way back in 1957 in a classic paper called The Ailment in the British Journal of Medical Psychology. Thomas Main said that the sufferer who frustrates a keen therapist by failing to improve is always in danger of meeting primitive human behavior disguised as treatment, something that I think probably still rings true today. And I can assure you that in state hospitals across the country, there are in the back wards patients with severe borderline personality disorder who are meeting primitive human behavior disguised as treatment. Well, DSM Valerie mentioned, I completely agree with her characterization of the process. A group of people got together in a smoke-filled back room and decided to try to get a handle on the fact that there was different nomenclature. There was a comprehensive literature review, and an effort to try to deal with this Tower of Babel by creating operational criteria for the disorder. From my perspective, I think separating schizotypal personality from borderline personality was critical in DSM. And schizotypal was, of course, people who were shy and withdrawn and had a tendency towards magical thinking. This was the personality disorder that's most related to schizophrenia, whereas borderline was quite a distinct condition. And in a way, I think the contribution of the DSM was to articulate the core clinical features of this disorder into operational criteria. Well, since then, what have been the major advances? This is just one man's view. I think we have a better understanding of the natural history. Particularly, there have been studies that suggest that the illness is most severe in the 20s and 30s, and there may be, in some instances, God willing, that it tends to improve with time by the time the patient is in their 40s. There's also a sense that this is not best understood as a unitary disorder, but rather as a condition that is made up of component dimensions, and I'll get back to that. There's beginning to have insight into the neurobiology of some of these dimensions. I think Barbara Stanley talked about this earlier. There's a beginning of rational approaches to pharmacology, and you'll hear more about this from Chuck Schultz tomorrow morning. And there's also, they're beginning now to be some evidence-based treatments, such as DBT and some psychodynamic treatments, and you'll hear about both of those approaches tomorrow, and I think that will be very important and very enlightening to hear about that. However, we still have barriers from the research standpoint to moving this field forward. And here are what some of them are, really. In designing a research study, people don't know, well, should you include patients with substance abuse or exclude patients with substance abuse? If you exclude it, then really the sample's not going to be typical of patients in the community. Same thing with co-occurring disorders. If you exclude all co-occurring disorders, you'll almost eliminate the generalizability of your study to any patient who's actually going to be seen in real life. How do you deal with medications, particularly in a research setting? Do you take patients with all medications? Well, if you're studying biology, that becomes problematic. Do you try to control the medications or have no medications at all? If you go with no medications, that becomes an ethical issue. And there are other issues, of course. You know, how do you deal in a research context with patients who are very, very crisis prone? Makes it difficult to do the research. Who's going to provide the clinical care and pay for it while the patient's in a research? All of these are real barriers. But I think what it boils down to is what you could call the Matthew effect. And this is, of course, from the Bible, where it says in Matthew, unto everyone that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away, even that which he hath. This is the phenomenon in research where people working in a well-worn area, in an area that's been already studied for 20 or 30 or 40 years, where you've gotten all the bugs out of the research system, that person is going to be far more likely to get a research grant than somebody working in a difficult area where the patients are oftentimes in chaotic circumstances and where the methods and ways of thinking about it are really not that well articulated. So here is the record, and it's not really a record that I think we ought to be very proud about regarding research, NIMH-supported research in borderline personality disorders over the two decades following DSM-3. You can see over these two decades, really 13 research studies. Now, over the past 4 years, we have really tried to invigorate this field and to make efforts to get more researchers into this field. And an important person in this has been Jim Breeling, who maybe you could stand up for a minute, Jim, who is in charge of overseeing this area. He has worked, I think many would agree, tirelessly, and in fact has achieved some results. Here, for example, is treatment-related studies over these two decades plus the last 4 years. And she can show that we are making some progress. This is a total of 25 treatment-related grants, if you include those supported by the Borderline Personality Disorder Research Foundation new grants over the last 4 years. So we're working on this area, but I think, as we heard from the advocates, there are still quite a ways to go. Here are some of the activities that have been engaged in to try to stimulate this. There were conferences in 2000 and 2002 to try to bring in young investigators and match them with the very small pool of established investigators in this area. An RFA in 2003, which means we set aside money that was going to be devoted specifically to this area. Try to forge a collaboration with the Swiss Borderline Personality Disorder Foundation, and they agreed to create a young investigator program, $75,000 a year, and establish investigator awards to match young people with established investigators to do research in this area. And an international think tank started in 2004 and organized by Jim Breeling to try to address some of these difficult methodological issues. Well, our current studies that we are supporting in this area fall broadly in these three areas: treatment studies, neurobiologic approaches to components of BPD, and course and outcome studies. And I just wanted to give you a flavor of what some of these studies and what some of these directions are. In terms of treatment studies, you'll hear tomorrow about dialectical behavior therapy. You heard some about it today. We're supporting Dr. Linehan at University of Washington in two studies. One is to modify DBT and use it along with Suboxone for borderline personality disorder patients with narcotics abuse and narcotics addiction. We're also supporting a research study, again, at University of Washington to try to dismantle DBT. As you'll hear tomorrow, it includes two components: skills training and individual therapy. So the question is, I think, you know, we heard again from the advocates that if you want to find a DBT therapist, you better start very early in the morning, because it's going to take a long time. This has not gotten out into the community mental health centers and out into clinicians' offices in the way that it should. So this is an effort to try to look at the two components individually and then together to see if it can be simplified in a way that will make it more easy to export and disseminate. We're supporting Dr. Stanley at Columbia University to do a study of DBT versus SSRIs versus both for suicidal behavior and borderline personality disorder. Dr. Don Black at the University of Iowa, who has developed a new form of behavioral group therapy and who's conducting a randomized clinical trial at this at the University of Iowa. And Dr. Linda Dimeff at the BTEC, who is trying to develop a computer-based DBT training program. This may have some bearing on the question that we heard at the end of the last panel: how can we get training? Again, it's very difficult to travel to Seattle, but if we feel if it's worth investing in exploring the possibility of whether computer modules can be developed to facilitate training of clinicians. Now, the second major area has to do with trying to understand the dimensions of dysregulation. And again, this relates to the idea that we feel that progress will be made not by considering BPD as a unitary disorder, but rather at looking at the different components within it. And you've heard about these today, components such as positive and negative affect, regulation of impulses, regulation of sense of self-identity, stress-related dissociative and other transient disturbances of consciousness, cognitive difficulties, and difficulties with relationships. We feel that these dimensions of the disorder, such as impulsivity, are probably closer to the underlying brain processes than the global diagnosis of BPD. And we're more likely to understand, for example, the underlying neurobiology of impulsivity defined narrowly than we are to understand the whole phenomenon of BPD. But yet, if we could understand that single dimension and develop a treatment for that dimension, I think you could agree that it would be a great advance, and it may tackle one of the most difficult aspects of this disorder. It also relates, I think, to the concept of individualized medicine, because people with BPD, some have dysregulation of all of these dimensions, some may have dysregulation of only one, two, three, or any combination. And again, I think we're in a situation now where we do give one treatment to all patients, and better understanding the components should lead to individualized treatments. Well, here's just some examples of studies that we're currently supporting with respect to neurobiology. At University of Michigan, a study of opioid-mediated stress regulation in BPD. Dr. Stanley mentioned this in passing, and it relates to the idea that endogenous opioids may have something to do with the process of dissociation, or the fact that, for example, when people with BPD do injure themselves, they often don't feel any pain. A study, Dr. McCluskey at University of Chicago, validation of a laboratory measure of self-aggression. Again, if we had a treatment that targeted aggression and gave it to patients, it would be difficult to tell whether it was working or not, because the patient's situation from day to day is changing. It may be that aggression is greater next week because somebody said something insulting to the person and they had an outburst. So if we had a better way of measuring these things independent, for example, of the day-to-day environmental fluctuations, we'd be in a far better position of developing treatments that are specific and testing them to see if they actually work. Another study is being done at Mount Sinai by Antonia Nu. This is a PET study which measures blood flow in areas of the brain. One theory about the dysregulation and the impulsivity in BPD has to do with the fact that there may be less input, inhibitory input, from the frontal parts of the brain into those parts of the brain that generate aggression and emotion. And that's something that can be measured and tested using PET by looking at the degree of activity in people with BPD during situations that stimulate anger. And again, being able to understand these neural circuits would hopefully down the road lead to treatments. Other studies at University of Pittsburgh focus on the psychobiology of suicidal behavior, talking, as you've heard about, again, looking at the density of serotonin receptors. And there's also effort, again, at Baylor University to develop an animal model of aggression and impulsivity by, for example, depleting all of the serotonin from the animal's brain. Again, animal models have proven to be very helpful in other disorders in terms of developing new treatments, particularly new drug treatments, and having a model of some components of BPD would then allow you to screen potential therapeutics in a way for a signal as to whether they're gonna work without exposing, you know, large numbers of human beings to that sort of testing. This is just a cartoon, really, that shows the fear circuit in the brain that, you know, it involves the visual thalamus, the visual cortex, and then the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that lights up when a person perceives a fearful situation. There have been very, very interesting studies showing that compared to normals, if you show people with BPD a face with neutral affect, the person with BPD is more likely to have the amygdala, or the part of the brain that mediates fear, light up, you know, suggesting that there's an overvaluation of threat, which, if you can imagine, combined with disinhibition, could result in anger and impulsivity and aggression. And this is really just to give a sense of where some of this may be leading. So from a research perspective, this is our wish list. We'd like to have more researchers and more projects. Clearly, we need more effective treatments, but as important, more effective treatment systems and services. This is an issue that extends beyond a research agency, but that relates to your state and local mental health authorities. as well as issues having to do with insurance parity and other things that have been brought up. We'd like to have objective measures of the dimensions of dysregulation so that we can better assess whether new treatments are working or not. And finally, an understanding of the fundamental neurobiology so that treatment addresses the core disturbances. I think, you know, many of our treatments today, particularly the medications, are just really snowing the patient with medication rather than carefully targeting what is the underlying problem. Essentially, I think at the end of the day, the research wish list is answers to those questions I mentioned in the beginning that make treatment so hard, patient and family suffering so severe, and clinician insecurity so vast. So this is where we are, and I think that there is really a tremendous amount that we do not know about this disorder. From a research perspective, we have not invested enough, just like from a treatment perspective, we haven't invested enough. So that really, really modesty is in order. And I think I'd like to end with this quote, which probably should be relevant to all of us working in this field, from Ann Sexton, who said that the doctors should fear arrogance more than cardiac arrest. Because if they're too proud, and some are, then they leave home on horseback, but God returns them on foot. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'd like to take some questions now. We have heard many presenters talk about BPD as an example of evidence-based treatment. I assume DBT. What about Kernberg et al., TFP, and other forms of psychoanalytically based treatments?
Well, I think that I'm going to defer that until tomorrow, because I think that tomorrow we're going to hear presentations from Dr. Kernberg and Dr. Fonagy, who will review the evidence that psychodynamic treatments are effective. And I think that this audience will be able to hear that evidence tomorrow and judge for yourself whether you believe that these are evidence-based treatments. I think it's certainly been a very great positive development in the field that that research studies have been designed, that these treatments have been tested in a research context, because it is important to find out whether they work and for whom they work.
Well, here's a corollary question, basically suggesting that NIMH is so focused on biologic, i.e. drug treatments for BPD, when there are effective behavioral psychotherapeutic treatments already available.
Well, I think that that probably is a fair criticism of NIMH. And probably it's fair to say across mental health science in general today, there is a substantial emphasis on biology. However, I will say, in addition to that, that NIMH has supported, for example, the development of what are many of the evidence-based practices, including funding that has demonstrated the effectiveness of Dr. Linehan's dialectical behavior therapy.
Okay. What about genes involved in the development of BPD? There is an international holotype project which hopes to identify genes involved in diseases. Do you think this will help BPD?
Some diseases are simple, like sickle cell anemia or Huntington's chorea, in that they have just one single gene that is responsible for them. The psychiatric disorders were complex genetic disorders, more akin to diabetes and hypertension, where you have probably at least half a dozen different genes involved with them. But let me address the issue specifically related to DBT. I think it's extremely unlikely that we will find any gene or combination of genes related specifically to DBT, again, because that's such a broad category. And the individual people who are labeled with BPD are very heterogeneous, different one person from the next. It is, however, possible, I think, that we'll find genes related to some of the underlying dimensions, such as impulsivity, affective dysregulation, and cognitive impairments. And those genes may provide clues to future treatments.
Okay, thanks. Two related questions. Given the Presidential Commission on Mental Health's emphasis on peer support and community programs, what grants or opportunities are available for BPD consumers to work with researchers on in integrating BPD evidence-based practices within recovery-based mental health programs?
Well, the area of dissemination is actually falls within the jurisdiction of an agency called the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Agency, which is SAMHSA. They provide funding to communities to implement services. And they have, after the President's Commission report, decided to focus their funding decisions on evidence-based practices. And included among those will be DBT. So that they're currently involved in creating, as it were, toolkits to implement treatments that are proven to be effective. And I think, believe the intention is to provide funding to local communities and states who decide in their public mental health systems to implement these evidence-based practices.
Okay, thanks. Related question, how can family members get Congress to adopt appropriate reports that recommend BPD research?
Well, I think as a federal employee, I'm not allowed to implore people to go to Congress. But I think, you know, we heard the answer right up here in the panel that came right before me. And as I discussed right in my very first slide, what we do with our money from at NIMH really is determined substantially by what Congress tells us to do with the money. They send the money along with a report that says you are not doing enough of this, you are not doing enough of that. And I think that probably people who are in this audience, after listening to the advocacy panel and listening to this discussion, can put two and two together.
Thanks. Are there any plans to fund novel studies beyond novel treatment modalities, psychotherapeutic treatment modalities beyond DBT, MBT, and TFP, transference focused psychotherapy?
I think the answer to that is yes. As a matter of fact, we are very interested in new therapeutics and novel therapeutics, both psychosocial and psychological, as well as pharmacological. So that if an application comes in that has a novel approach to BPD, that is going to get very, very serious attention. And all things being equal, because we know that this is an area that's underfunded, if we get two applications, one in an area where as I said before, it's a well-worn path that people have been working for the last 30, 40 years, and want an application to test a novel treatment in borderline personality disorder. And if they're both scored comparably in terms of scientific quality, we are going to select the area where the public health need is the greatest.
Okay, thanks. Well, this should be an easy one. Can we get a copy of your slides?
Yes, it is on this computer and can be, I presume the conference organizers can, well, Dixie Ann is saying, nodding yes, can probably have it copied and perhaps distribute it tomorrow.
So the answer is yes.
And I apologize for not providing them in advance.
Question is, have you looked into, is it body dynamics, a body-centered treatment?
I don't know what that is. Does the person who asked it want to say more? No?
No. That's it for the questions, at least that we have. No more questions. Thank you very much for that excellent talk.